Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear arguments from petitioner in Austin versus Helpful.
May I please support Mr. Greg Rosenberg, represent arguments from petitioner. Petitioner has served 7 minutes.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Greg Rosenberg, and it is my privilege to appear before this distinguished court to present argument on behalf of my client, Abigail Austin. I suppose, as is the case in many cases which come before this court, that the underlying facts are somewhat secondary to the legal issues being presented. However, I would like to briefly acquaint you with the facts giving rise to Ms. Austin's claim. Ms. Austin worked as an emergency room nurse at the Gulf Coast Medical Center in Wharton. In July of 1992, she reported to her supervisor that a coworker, who was a fellow nurse, was stealing narcotics for his own benefit and working under the apparent influence of narcotic drugs. As is the case in most wrongful discharge cases, the respondent, in its brief on the merits, has apparently claimed that Ms. Austin's termination was due to something which had nothing to do with her report of her coworker. However, in moving for summary judgment, the only basis that the respondent brought before the court was that Texas law does not provide a remedy for the facts alleged. I point this out because it's brief on the merits. The respondent claims that Ms. Austin was terminated because of her refusal to treat a black patient. I believe that's a highly inflammatory allegation. This morning, however, we're not here to determine the true reason for Ms. Austin's termination. That's a question left for people more suited than us to answer the question, in this case, the Wharton County Jury. We're here to discuss whether or not, on the facts alleged, Ms. Austin has a cause of action that is or should be recognized under Texas law.
Would she have one under existing statutes now?
Under existing statutes now, no. They point out, the respondents in one of the amicus curiae, Article 4525A, which is the nursing statute.
Yes.
That statute was passed by the legislature in 1983. However, subsequent amendments to that statute came into fruition in later times. There's one section which deals with wrongful discharge in that statute. It's Section 11. It's either 11 or 11A. If you look at the enactment date of that, I believe it was September of 1993. It was definitely 1993, and they're all passed in September, so it was after the cause of action accrued. So the answer to you was that there would be no statutory remedy.
If the circumstances arose today, she would have a statutory remedy?
No, also, because that statute addresses complaints made to the state agency governing nurse examiners, not to your supervisor. So the answer again would be no.
What about Section 161, 134 of the Health and Safety Code?
That deals with nursing homes.
No, that's 242, 133. 161, 134 is about hospitals.
Yeah, hospitals, coworkers, she may or may not have a cause of action. The enactment of that statute was, again, subsequent to the cause of action in this case.
It was in 1993 again.
Right. There was a wave of legislative activity right about that time.
So what you're saying, let me clarify this, and that is that there has been, since this instance arose, there has been legislative action creating a cause of action for this type of situation when the report is made to a governmental agency.
Correct.
Why does that not lend credence to the notion that the legislature is considering this? They could have established this cause of action not only for reporting to an agency, but also for reporting to a supervisor or some other authority at the hospital. And why would that not, since they did decide not to go down that route, why should that not mitigate towards a conclusion that we shouldn't go down that route either?
Well, because we have, our Texas Supreme Court has recognized a public policy exception to the at-will doctrine. Not every single question is rightly brought before the legislature. The at-will doctrine is, as we all know, is a judicially created doctrine. This court said in Sabine Pilot that we have the power to amend a judicially created doctrine. That's well within your power. The legislature simply can't, when the legislature acts in enacting these statutes, as I see it, it acts in a reactive mode rather than a proactive mode.
But in either branch, what we're trying to get at is what's good for the public? What should the law be in that circumstance? And why doesn't the rejection of House Bill 62 indicate that at least that branch has decided this is not a good idea?
I can't speak for what was behind the legislature. I don't lobby the legislature. I try plaintiff's cases, obviously. But what I see happening in this situation is you have a balance, that you have a conversion of interests dividing the legislature, and we're not able to come up with a true method in how we would enforce or police such a statute. The reason why the House bill that you just cited did not pass was not a policy issue as to whether or not we should have a private right of action whistleblower case, but it was what guidelines, and the hang-up was on the guidelines. There was a sole cause question. There was a view that took Justice Doggett's approach of how to resolve these whistleblower cases. And if you look at it, Justice Doggett and what this court subsequently did in the Hines case, where you have a subjective and an objective standard, does really address the causation issue that this court already addressed. I believe that this court is more suited to determine causation and standards of causation than is the legislature, because the questions have been posed to this court many times since. In fact, in Hines, I hate to say if you look closely at your own opinion, but if you look closely at your own opinion, you don't limit it to whistleblower cases. You limit it to, or you actually expand the causation theory to whistleblower and similar cases. And I may be misusing a word, but the notion I got when I read Hines was that the causation standard was not only for whistleblower cases, but wrongful discharge cases in general. In fact, as you all know, we just came out with a pattern jury charge, which I'm proud to say I was an editor of. That's the standard we used because it was mandated by the Supreme Court, the causation issue. I'll be the first person to step forward and say that the relationship between employers and employees in this state, the employment will doctrine, should remain substantially inviolate. Obviously, I agree with and support all of these exceptions, these statutory exceptions that Justice Heck brought out that preceded that, Article 451, which we used to call 8307C, the Commission on Human Rights Act, and statutory legislation such as that. I strongly disagree, and I wish to make this point very, very clear, I strongly disagree with a total eradication of the employment will doctrine. An employer, as I see it, should be free to fire and hire at will, and likewise an employee should be free to come as he does. I think that's fairly clear. I'm not looking to open up a new Pandora's box here. There are instances, as in this case, where we've got to look back at the common denominator. The common denominator is public policy. Public policy sometimes mandates that we take a closer look at fundamental principles of law, such as the at-will doctrine.
Well, hasn't the legislature done that? I mean, why should we create a cause of action that's any broader than the one created by the legislature?
There's only so much, Justice Owen, that we can legislate. We can't foresee every single instance occurring. Let's take a very remedial issue. Let's say you have a restaurant worker who observes that the restaurant is intentionally putting out contaminated food that could potentially cause botulism. Obviously, that's a public policy interest right there. But the owner of the restaurant says, you keep doing that. We bought this meat, we've got to get it out, and the restaurant worker complains about it. Well, under the state of the law as it is right now, even though there's a strong public policy concern, there's no remedy for this person if he either reports it to a supervisor that a co-worker is doing this, or, you know, if he refuses to do it, there's a question because of the criminal penalties mandate in the Sabine Pilot Doctrine. We can't then ask the legislature to come up with the Board of Restaurant Examiners and make that an anti-retaliation, make an anti-retaliation provision there. The legislature simply can't cover the waterfront. There's too much there. And that's my problem. That's why we've got to look at public policy and underlying policy, whether or not the facts of the case before this court are strong enough to add a little branch, not a bifurcation, but a little expansion to the public policy exception. As this court said in Winters versus the Houston Chronicle, this court did not forego the possibility of expanding the public policy exception to the at-will doctrine. It simply said, we're not willing to do it at this time on this set of facts. Two times since then that I know of, the Thompson case and the Burgess case, the plaintiffs in that case invited this court to accept the case on application for writ of error. Writ was denied in both of these cases. If you look at Burgess, Thompson, and Winters, all you have, excuse the expression, but all you have in those cases is whining and complaining. Somebody's having an affair with somebody. Somebody is misappropriating company goods for his own good. Somebody's working for personal gain on company time. Things of that nature.
Burgess was a little more serious.
Well, that Burgess had some equipment going into radiation activity, but if you read further in Burgess, the allegations also were that, I don't remember if that was the affair or somebody working on private business, but there were other allegations. And I refer to that as a shotgun petition where somebody will just allege a myriad cause of action. I wasn't the one who was inclined to accept writ of error on it, but as I see it, trying to decipher in my own mind in preparation for this argument, the reason why writ was not granted was because of the public policy concerns. As I see it, this case invites the opportunity. The factual scenario is present. We can all agree, all of us sitting in this room, whether we're on the court or not, that there is a great public policy interest in whether or not an emergency room nurse is A, going to steal drugs from the hospital when no orders were written for these drugs, or administer care to somebody while they're under the influence of alcohol. And that's the difference. That's the very strong difference.
Under the law at the time of incident, if this had been reported, what action does the board take?
It wasn't reported to the board.
No, but the law allowed reporting of illegal activity.
And you're assuming in this case the report was made to the board.
If it had been made, what does the board do with that?
From a wrongful discharge perspective or from a... It initiates an investigation. It goes to the factual merits of the allegations and it rectifies the situation.
Can it take away a license of a nurse or something of that nature?
I believe it could. In this case, for example, I'm sorry, my time's up and I'll answer your question. In this case, as I understand it, the nurse who was involved allegedly stealing the drugs is no longer working there. That person's been terminated.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Chad Shelf will present argument for the respondent.
Ms. Shelf, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
There is a statute that requires Ms. Austin, I guess, to report to the appropriate authority this misconduct.
Yes, sir.
If she fails to report that misconduct, is there some sort of sanction against her?
Yeah, it says in the statute that the board can take some type of action against her. I think it's section 10 of that statute.
Is there, if in the Sabine Pilot circumstance, it was an employee who refused to obey an order that would have been, in his view, an illegal activity?
Yes, sir.
In this case, an order from the supervisor to Ms. Austin to not report the conduct, is that a requirement by an employer to do an illegal act?
No, sir, it's not, because the reporting, the duty to report, and what you talked about first is what happens if she doesn't report, it's civil penalty, not criminal penalty. So it is not illegal for her not to report. Therefore, it would not be illegal, or they would not be asking her to, you know, do an illegal act by not reporting.
Does this become a much closer question in this case, where the nurse reports to the employer conduct that ought to be reported to an appropriate authority and the employer tells her not to report? Does this become actually a closer case to Sabine Pilot than at first blush?
I don't think it does, because I think that there's specific law that says she is to report it. If she does report it, then she's already protected under these statutes, not only from retaliation, but also protected. She's immune from a lawsuit from the person that she's alleging is doing something wrong. They can't come back after her on a defamation claim, something like that. And that's why it's so important that the court give deference to the law that's already there, because it's more specific than what the petitioner's asking for here. It sends a message to every registered nurse that if you report inappropriate conduct, and it sets out what that is, doesn't always have to be illegal, it could be other things. If you report that, then the law will protect you. The law gives you the anti-retaliation plus the immunity. And the important message that's sent to that is, we want reports to the board so that the board can keep track of who there's reports against and can police its own occupation. Where if you were to grant what the petitioner is asking for here, it wipes that whole thing out. Because it's saying, you don't have to report to the board to still get this protection. Plus, that statute has specific other guidelines in it that require people to do certain things, when to report, when there's a presumption, all that kind of stuff. And if the court were to come back with adopting this exception, that would eliminate that. The other issue, or the other statute that's very important here, is a more general statute that was passed by the legislature in 1993 that says that you can report that all hospital employees, not just registered nurses, but all employees can report in this, any, I guess, illegal act. And under that statute, you would be required to bring a lawsuit if you are retaliated against, you are required to bring a lawsuit within 180 days. If the court were to adopt what the petitioner is asking for here, why would anybody fall under, why would you use that statute? Why, I mean, that completely really eliminates that statute that the legislature has already done. Another important thing in this case to keep in mind is that the legislature specifically looked at House Bill 622 in 1995 and said, this catch-all, one-size-fits-all whistleblower statute is not something that we're willing to adopt. The original House Bill 622 said, an employee who in good faith reports activities within the workplace that constitute a violation of the law or would otherwise have probable adverse effect on the public, resulting in physical harm or hazard to the public health or safety. And that was rejected in committee. Then they tried to tone it down, and they substituted a proposal that says that the activities to be reported have to be illegal, and the legislature again rejected that. What they've said is that we want to, instead of using a broad one-size-fits-all type statute, we want to pick out what things we think are most important. We want to decide who you would make that report to, because there's lots bigger issues than just protecting a whistleblower. In this court, in 1993, in the case Graff versus Beard, it said, we think it's significant in appraising petitioner's request to recognize common law social host liability
that the legislature has considered and declined to create such a duty. And that's exactly what we got in this case. Instead, what the legislature's done is, specifically for registered nurses, way back in 1987, it said that if you're a registered nurse and you have reason to suspect that another registered nurse, which is what we've got in this situation, has exposed or is likely to expose a patient or other person unnecessarily to a risk of harm, and then it goes on to say, or if that nurse is impaired, then you have a duty to report that in a signed written report to the board. Now, she didn't do that, otherwise she would have sued under that statute. But what you pointed out is, if this had happened today, she would not only have that statute to rely upon, but she would also have the Texas Health and Safety Code, which is section 161.134, and that provides a cause of action for an employee who believes that his or her hospital employer has retaliated against him or her for reporting a violation of the law. Both of those statutes give a potential plaintiff in a case like that actual damages, exemplary damages, attorney's fees, reinstatement, lost wages, lost benefits. And also, in the Texas Health and Safety Code, the legislature said, we think this is so important that we're going to require every hospital or health facility that falls within that statute to post this requirement, post this statute, so that the people who work there know that if they make a report of illegal conduct, they're protected. The legislature is, I'm sorry.
Since 1987, the legislature has enacted several statutes. Why doesn't that indicate a movement toward more general whistleblowing liability?
I think what it indicates is a movement that we're going to pick out the ones that are most important, and we will make statutes to address those. And the legislature specifically said, we are not going to use just a broad brush and cover complete whistleblower. And that's what I talked about, what they did back in 1995. And in 97, the issue never even came up with the legislature. But they have addressed issues, especially since the pilot being in 1985, I guess they got the message that this is something important and that they need to make these laws in particular areas. But they look at it from a different view than what the court looks at it. Instead of addressing or creating law based on the facts of one person, they're looking at it from a much broader perspective. And instead of just protecting whistleblowers, they're saying, okay, what's important in this situation? I think what's important is we want registered nurses reporting that other registered nurses are doing something improper. And we, as a legislature, think that the Board of Nursing needs to know that so that they can monitor their own. They've done something similar to that with doctors. And instead of saying, we're going to take a huge exception in, or a huge broad brush, we're going to make specific issues. Now, recently, a case came out of this court just 2 weeks ago, Bo Hatch versus Butler and Binion, the one about partners in a law firm. And I guess that addressed at will. But the reason I bring it up is the concern, as I understand it, in the concurrence and in the dissent, was what kind of message are we sending to other partners in a law firm? Well, the same thing ought to be looked at in this case, and that is, what kind of a message are we sending to registered nurses? I think what you want to send is a message that says, if you follow the law that's already there and report it to the appropriate board, then the law will protect you. And that's something that's completely different than what we had in the Bo Hatch situation.
Conversely, the message to the healthcare industry is that if you help that does not follow the statute that goes directly to your supervisor, you're going to get fired and you have no remedy.
Well, if it's an illegal act, well, then the other statute steps in. You don't have to report that to the board. You can report that to a supervisor.
You mean drugs is not illegal?
Yes, I'm saying under that statute that we've got, they would be covered if they were to go to a supervisor, administrator, state agency, or to a law enforcement agency. And that's under the Texas Health and Safety Code, section 161.134. So they are protected. It's not necessary in that situation if it's not a registered nurse. It's not necessary to report that to a board. You can do that through a supervisor. And in this situation, she could have if that happened today, she could have taken advantage of both of those statutes. And this wouldn't be, they wouldn't be asking the court to create a common law exception for this situation.
So if we were to find in their favor, we would be in essence adopting what the legislature subsequently enacted.
No, actually what you would be doing by that is eliminating these statutes. Because like I said, if there's a 180-day statute of limitations that the legislature has seen to be important, if you create this, my understanding is there would be a two-year statute of limitations that's applied to common torts. And it would, why would anybody have to hurry to file within 180 days? And obviously, the legislature thought that that was an important public policy issue, too, is that if you're going to have one of these claims, you need to do it in a timely manner so that employers aren't sitting there wondering what is going to happen in the future. Now, there's a big difference between what came out in the Sabine Power or Sabine Pilot case versus what we're talking about today. Telling somebody you either have to commit an illegal act or you're going to be unemployed is much different than what we've got in this situation, especially where this woman had remedies. If she had reported to the board, she would have been covered and under the new statute.
Is there anything in the record that Justice Enoch was inquiring that the employer told her not to report or anything of that nature?
No, there's nothing in the record. What she says is that she was told by her supervisor not to tell anybody about this. And the other thing that's in the record, but since it was a summary judgment, we didn't bring this out, was he said that because he didn't want word to get back to the person who was taking the drugs before he could complete his investigation and confront this person and say, are you stealing drugs from us and taking them at work? So that's what the record will show. The example that the petitioner, or the rule that the petitioner wants us to set up, really can also create some situations, some absurd situations, but one that could easily come up is someone working in a hospital who goes to their supervisor or administrator and says, I've noticed that the residents are working 12-hour shifts, and it is my reasonable belief, good faith belief, that that causes a potential danger to the public. I've noticed that after 11 hours they start to get tired, that kind of thing. Now certainly that is not something that's illegal, and secondly, there are studies to show that there's nothing improper about that, and that's the best way for these residents to learn, that kind of thing. But if you've got a situation where that person then gets fired, say 2 months down the road, for whatever reason, they would have a potential claim under this because they can come in and say, well, I raised that issue and I think that because of that, I was terminated. This is more than just a little exception. I mean, this would create a flood of litigation because just about in any situation, an employer who thinks that they have been wronged by their employment being terminated can come up with, at some point, they disagreed with their employer about some issue. They had good faith reason to believe that there was something that the employer should change. But I don't think that the court wants to create an exception that would make it so that...
Exception doesn't have to be that broad to...
Excuse me?
The exception doesn't have to be nearly that broad to encompass the relief petitioner seeks here.
But the relief that the petitioner seeks here is specific to the registered nurse situation. And there's already statutes that cover that much more specifically. And what the court would be saying by doing anything other than affirming the summary judgment is saying, first, we recognize that the legislature specifically looked at this issue in 1993 and turned it down, but we still think that there ought to be a change. And also, it's saying we're going to eliminate not only the two statutes that I've talked about, but there's plenty of other statutes. Like you point out, since 1987, the legislature has adopted many statutes to cover different areas.
Haven't we created common law remedies that ended on the date a statute comes effective? And I'm thinking of El Chico versus Poole. One such is, maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think that's what happened, but I'm not... that familiar with that case.
There's nothing to prevent this court from giving Ms. Austin a remedy, as they've requested, make it coextensive with the statute that was subsequently passed. We can do anything with the judicially created exception, do we not?
It could, but what it does is it eliminates really.
How do they eliminate it? Does it be parallel?
Well,
just give her a remedy.
But the statute of limitations changes.
We can do
the remedies available.
We can do the same thing here. We can do anything we want to with a judicially created cause of action and put any limits we want to. And we don't annul any statute. We just make it coextensive.
But why do that if there's already
to give her a remedy? Simple as that.
To give this specific person.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
But that creates so many problems. And there's already a statute that would apply to anybody in her situation. In fact, if she had done the right thing, she would have a remedy.
Well, the anti-retaliation statutes were not in place at the time this incident occurred, were they?
I don't think that's right. I think that part of this, there may have been a part of that statute that was amended, but it's not something that was added. There were already the anti-retaliatory part of that statute was already in existence. He's right, there was an amendment to it, but it wasn't something that created that in 1993. That remedy was available to her if she
did. The duty for her to report was to the board or an appropriate authority.
To the board or to TPAP, which is the Texas Peer.
That exists at the time, and it's your view that also another provision exists at that time that had she done that, she would have been protected in some measure.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that's what she should have done. That's what the board wants those reports so that they can govern their own.
The supervisor, tell her, don't take this complaint to me. Take it to this other authority here, because we're interested in public policy. We want to do what's right for our patients. You've given it to me, but let me tell you, we're the wrong entity to file this complaint. Take it to this board.
Well, that's not what happened. Is they immediately did report it. That supervisor, who is also a registered nurse, did what the statute requires them.
But then they got rid of the
whistleblower. And it was reported. Excuse me?
And then they got rid of Ms. Austin.
6 months later, she was terminated, right. And, you know, I mean, I don't agree with the facts that they've got in the case, but on summary judgment, our theory all along was there is no common law cause of action in this case. And to date, there still is not. But there is a statutory remedy. And if she would have pursued that, we wouldn't be here. Maybe you're on a different issue, but we will be on this one. The Sabine Pilot case sent a message that upholding state and federal laws carrying criminal penalties is an important public policy, and that people shouldn't have to choose between unemployment and being a criminal. A message in this case should be that we think it's important for an employee, especially those in a profession like nursing where there are statutory protections, that employee follow the laws that have been set up for that profession. Doing that sends a message not only to everybody that's in that particular profession, but it also sends a message to the legislature that we will uphold the laws that you've created. We like these kind of laws. This healthcare laws, we want you to encourage people to make these reports and that encourage them to pass similar laws where they think there's a specific need, not a broad brush exception, but where there's a need for it. Go ahead.
Mr. Schultz, before you sit down, let me help me understand your argument. You're saying that at the time of this incident, at the time the suit was filed, she had a statutory cause of action against anti-retaliation protection.
Yes, sir, that is my understanding.
Under what statute?
And under the statute, that is under the Texas Revised Statute 4525A. Section 11 is the anti-retaliation provision of that statute.
Did her supervisor immediately report this? I mean, if that's correct, then there would be no reason for her to report.
Well, what he did is he reported this to the Texas Peer Assistance, called TPAP. He reported there, and the statute specifically says you can either report it to the board or you can report it to TPAP. He then also reported it to the board. So there was a report made. But the statute says, and it wants to encourage, make sure that that, you know, I mean, you could imagine a situation where a supervisor says, well, let's not report this. I mean, that's why the court says the registered nurse has to report it, not make sure you're supervising.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court in rebuttal, Justice Gonzalez, in the brief that they filed, the similar question, such as one you just asked, was answered by Mr. Schultz himself. Section 11A did not come to us until September of 1993. The answer to your question, did Ms. Austin have a remedy back then, is no. On page 15 of their brief, footnote 9, they talk about 161.134. They talk about that. And Mr. Schultz himself says, because this statute was enacted in September 1993, it is not applicable to the instant case. Well, if that statute, 161, was not enacted until September of 1993, and Section 11A was not enacted until September of 1993, why should there be any difference when Mr. Schultz concedes in his brief that the second statute I just cited wouldn't apply? Members of the court, Ms. Austin did the right thing. She reported illegal activity that had a very, very highly potentially adverse effect on the public health and welfare of whatever citizens of this state were being treated in the emergency room at that time. Counsel brought up the Butler and Binion case. I'm going to use very, very poor English, but it's a published opinion. I'm going to read, at least it's a concurring opinion. What's the use? You learning to do right when it's troublesome to do right and ain't no trouble to do wrong, and the wages is just the same. If Linda Gale Austin would have sat on her chair and watched this take place, she would still be a nurse at the Wharton Hospital.
I'm clear here. She reported this to someone at the hospital, her supervisor?
Her supervisor.
And then action was taken? Is that the record?
Yes, that's, you know, it's unclear, Justice Spector, what's in the record and what's out. I'm not going to come to this court and say Mr. Schultz is arguing outside the record, but what I understand from the way this case was pled or some of the pleadings that were filed is that there's an allegation that the person to whom the whistle was blown to, the supervisor, was a personal friend of the alleged drug user and misappropriator. That's
my question is, she reports what she believes to be unlawful activity, and she was not terminated for 6 months. Within that 6 months, was action taken according to what she had reported?
I don't agree with the 6 months. I think it was less of a time than that, but action was taken.
By the hospital or?
Yeah, well, I think I agree with counsel that there was a report eventually filed and an investigation took place, and the alleged misappropriator was not working anymore. There's a statute of limitations question brought up. As this court might recall, statute of limitations was never really addressed in the common law Sabine Pilots doctrine. The first time this court ever addressed statute of limitations in wrongful discharge cases that were not already provided for by statute, you were in a case, and I'm having trouble remembering the style, but it came to you from the El Paso Court of Appeals. It's Johnson's in the style somewhere. In that case, this court adopted a 2-year statute of limitations for wrongful discharge cases. It was a case where the cause of action accrued when the person first realized that her job was no longer there. I'm not so certain that doesn't deserve another look. I don't have any problem with a shorter statute of limitations.
How does this court create an 18-month statute? Statute of limitations are created by the legislature.
I understand that.
How do we judicially, by fiat, say, well, we're going to create a new cause of action. Oh, by the way, you've only got 18 months to burn.
I don't think you can, but I'm just saying I don't have any problem with the fundamental appropriation or assigning of a lower statute of limitation, because in every other wrongful discharge claim, we're used to working with 90-day statute of limitations, such as the one in the whistleblower. I don't know if that's a question that can be resolved by this court, because I think the legislature has to enact a statute of limitations in that situation. You go back to a two-year statute. I think it's cleaner. I mean, I will concede this. I think it's cleaner to have a tighter statute of limitations. I just don't know how it's done. I think that the Whistleblower Act has one, the Commission on Human Rights Act, all of the statutory cause of action are recognized, except the workers' compensation retaliation statute have a prescribed statute of limitations. The law offers protection, it's clear, but that didn't happen in this case, but wouldn't happen until afterwards. The wrongful discharge statute, we've been through this in this argument alone, didn't happen until after the cause of action accrued and Ms. Austin was left with no remedy. There was a question about whether or not this is appropriately left to the Texas legislature, this question. There's been some instances where there's been conflict or miscommunication between the Supreme Court and the Texas legislature. Most recently, the Light versus Sentel Cellular case dealing with covenants not to compete. You remember that this court issued its opinion in DeSantis versus Walking Hut. The legislature followed with some guidelines for the governing of covenants not to compete. What they did was take out the public interest factor. Then this court came back in the Light case and defined what consideration was and illusory consideration and basically had to put Humpty Dumpty back together again after the legislature took a shot at it. Now, I'm not casting a stone at the legislature. I just think that although there are some questions that are better left for the legislature, when we're talking about the amendment of a judicially created doctrine, that's better left to this court.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the oral arguments in the preceding four causes, all of which were submitted to us on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now standing.